WJCT in Jacksonville. This is our weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. I'm your host, Vince Kong, and this is Redux. It's April 28th, and it's finally over. On this episode of Redux, we bring you what local and state politicians have decided on two topics that have drifted in and out of the headlines consistently in recent years. That's ride-sharing apps and, of course, pensions. But while these issues are wrapping up, we're just getting started with another. That's the trial of former Congresswoman Corrine Brown. Then, Duval County Schools is cleaning house and some programs facing the chopping block might surprise you. We'll also let you know about a program the school district is starting to help turn non-educators into teachers. And finally, the use of tobacco has gone down in each age group in Duval County, that is, except for millennials. Find out why. But first, some news. Here's an update to a story from one of our first podcasts. Ken Atkins, the South Georgia pastor convicted of child molestation earlier this month, has been sentenced to 35 years in prison. Atkins was the pastor of Greater Dimensions Christian Fellowship in Brunswick, Georgia. He was convicted of sexually assaulting a 15-year-old boy in 2010. Folks in Jacksonville know Atkins because last year, when city leaders were debating whether to expand the city's human rights ordinance to include LGBT people, the 57-year-old minister was one of the most vocal opponents, even speaking on a panel organized by Mayor Lenny Curry. The Jacksonville City Council eventually approved the expanded HRO in February. That's right, the end appears to be in sight. After 4 years of fierce debate, Florida lawmakers have passed state regulations for ride-hailing apps like Uber and Lyft. If Governor Rick Scott signs the measure, all local regulations for the app-based transportation companies would be void. As WJCT's Ryan Bank reports, one Jacksonville City Councilman says the new law has him determined to level the playing field by deregulating traditional taxicabs.
Jacksonville City Councilmen John Cressenbeny and Matt Schellenberg have fallen on opposite sides of the debate over the competing interest of taxis and their millennial high-tech cousins. Schellenberg, a supporter of the disruptive companies, is thrilled about the bill's passage.
This is great news for the citizens of Duval County as well as the state of Florida.
The measure awaiting the governor's signature is essentially the same as what Schellenberg has proposed on the local level. It requires Uber and Lyft drivers to carry a $1 million insurance policy covering passengers. It also requires them to undergo third-party background checks every 3 years. Local governments are generally opposed to the measure because it prevents new regulations. But Schellenberg, who sits on the Florida League of Cities board, says that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Sometimes it takes this a bill that is universal to allow great businesses to exist.
Cressenbeny says he isn't against looser restrictions, as long as they apply to everyone.
If it's good enough for TNCs, it ought to be damn good enough for taxi cabs.
Cressenbeny wants to use the state bill as a model to deregulate taxis. Jacksonville, like most cities, has special requirements for cabs, like city-approved background checks, special operating licenses called medallions, and more expansive insurance coverage. The state law also won't prevent airports from signing exclusivity contracts with ride-hailing apps. Jacksonville International Airport just finished inking such a deal with Lyft. Cressenbeny says he'll file his taxi bill within the next month. Ryan Bank, WJCT News.
Switching gears to matters of education, it's unclear whether Duval School's academic coaches and interventionists are producing results. This is according to a recent review. Now, as WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride reports, school board members are preparing to weed out district-funded programs that are not serving students as intended.
The process is called strategic abandonment, letting go of programs that aren't working. Of 37 programs and organizations scrutinized, just under half received a score of questionable. One was rated unacceptable, and 22 were rated as worth funding. Some of the initiatives rated questionable include centers that serve students who would otherwise get out-of-school suspension called ATOS, Teach for America, and reading and math coaches and interventionists. Coaches mostly work with teachers. Interventionists tend to work with small groups of students. Board member Scott Shine says the report could help the district reprioritize.
What we found, there's about $40 million in programs today that might not be giving us a good return, may not be helping children the way we want.
He says that's especially important in light of a state bill that could significantly cut the district's capital funding. But other board members say they need more information about several of the programs before making any decisions. They're continuing budget discussions for the upcoming school year. Lindsay Kilbride, WJCT News.
Also, Duval County Schools is looking for help. It needs qualified teachers and is actively recruiting non-educators to help fill the void. An information and screening session will be held next Friday at the Administration Building on Prudential Drive. Visit the Redux page at wjctnews.org for more information. The federal corruption trial of former Democratic Northeast Florida Congresswoman Corrine Brown began this past week. Brown spent 24 years in Congress and is charged with 22 counts of fraud and conspiracy, many of those charges stemming from her connection to a shell education charity prosecutors allege was really her personal slush fund. Florida Times Union reporter Nate Monroe was on First Coast Connect earlier this week to lay out what's in store for the next roughly 3 weeks this trial is expected to last.
It's important to keep in mind that there are really two things here that Corrine needs to worry about. And the first is the One Door for Education story, which a sham nonprofit that prosecutors say she enriched herself with. The other prong to their prosecution involves tax fraud allegations. And these are basically saying that she didn't disclose her income for several years, that she fabricated charitable contributions to churches and schools and nonprofits. And to prove their case, I mean, they're going to walk through an exhaustive list of exhibits. They've got bank records for Corrine. They've got bank records for the sham nonprofit. You know, they're going to talk to FBI forensic auditors. They're going to talk to, of course, a long list of witnesses. It's going to be a long case.
And during opening arguments, Brown's attorneys say she placed her trust in Chief of Staff Ronnie Simmons and was unaware of his fraudulent behavior. Meanwhile, prosecutors counter that Simmons routinely withdrew money from One Door for Education and deposited those funds into Brown's personal bank account with her knowledge.
She's going to ask the jury to believe two things. One is that she is this very influential member of Congress who is very involved and did all these great things, but also that she sort of displayed a kind of a remarkable lack of disengagement with aspects of her personal and professional life. Like, she's not responsible for money going into and coming out of her bank account.
Brown is expected to take the stand before the trial is over. If convicted on all charges, she faces 350 years in prison and a fine of close to $5 million. Visit WJCTnews.org for continuing coverage of the trial. Also sprinkled throughout this podcast will be comments from you, our listeners, about the trial of Corrine Brown.
This is a well-planned, orchestrated effort to destroy her credibility. It's very interesting that when she began to go for her bid to be reelected, all of this came up. This came up before the reelection or during the reelection, as to put a disparaging light on her character. And of course, it certainly influenced the outcome of the election. This was a concerted effort statewide and local to destroy her. And I think that people can see through that. But now that we've got to go through this litigation, she's tied up in the system.
That was one of our callers, Troy from Jacksonville.
If you're looking for the best in classic and modern blues, tune in every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 right here on 89.9. for Blues Horizon, from the artists you know to the artists you should know. Blues Horizon collects the best of a legacy of music that spans the century. As part of WJCT's After Hours, Blues Horizon, every Monday and Wednesday night at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music. Coming up next.
More than one in three youth that are aged 11 to 17 in our county report trying tobacco products.
That was the bad news. Now stay tuned for the good news. But first, abortion laws, felon voting rights, and open elections are all issues Jacksonville residents would like to see addressed in the Florida Constitution. As WJCT's Lindsay Kilbride reports, that's what they told the state's Constitutional Revision Committee earlier this week at Florida State College, Jacksonville.
Every 20 years, a state constitutional revision commission meets to propose changes to the document after holding public hearings across the state. In Jacksonville, several people asked for felons to have their voting rights restored after serving their sentence. Others spoke for or against requiring a waiting period before a woman can have an abortion. Leanne Gustavus spoke in favor of open primary elections. She's registered as an independent, so she couldn't vote in the presidential Democratic or Republican primaries.
Your voting voice isn't heard until, you know, the final election, and by then you've only got two people to choose from. You know, I didn't get to get my voice heard, you know, because I would have voted for Bernie had I could.
She came with several others who spoke on the same issue. Other speakers didn't come with the group. 24-year-old FSCJ student Adrian Miller asked for easier access to college, like more financial aid or, ideally, free tuition.
When you have your rent is due, a class doesn't seem as important. Sometimes kids flunk out and then they can't pay for classes out of pocket until they're eligible for financial aid again. Sometimes school suffers.
Other people spoke about gun laws. One man said he'd like his daughters to be able to carry a gun on their college campuses. The commission is made up of 37 members, mostly appointed by Governor Rick Scott and Republican legislative leaders. Whatever constitutional amendments they propose will appear on state ballots next year, and 60% of voters must approve them. Lindsay Kilbride, WJCT News.
There's no doubt in my mind. She broke the law 22 times at least. She's been charged, and these are facts. And there's no way to whitewash it or smooth it over. If you break the law in this country, there's repercussions. You know, you're going to wind up on trial. You're going to go to jail. And what's interesting is how they're rallying different people in different aspects to come to her aid and say, well, because she's been doing this 20, 30 years, we got to give her a break on this and this and that. Well, it doesn't work that way. You break the law, you've been charged with, I guess, 22 felonies, something like that. Anyone else, this would be a non-issue, right? They're going to jail.
That was one of our callers, Steve, from Ponte Vedra Beach. Now, Mayor Lenny Curry has signed into law the biggest policy priority of his administration earlier this week. Yep, we're talking about pension reform. It's true, some council members admit it isn't the silver bullet for all of Jacksonville's funding woes, but they did all agree it's the best plan they've seen because it includes a dedicated funding source. That's the half-cent sales tax voters passed last August, which will cover pension costs after the year 2030. In Curry's closing remarks at a special council meeting, he issued this warning.
As we've kept the promises, the men and women in uniform, policemen, firemen and women, city employees, we've kept the promise by securing a source of revenue that already exists. We're compensating them now in a way that they've long been neglected, having suffered pay cuts and no pay raise. And ladies and gentlemen, do not let this be lost on us today. When you solve a problem, you want to make sure it doesn't happen again. This is history. We are out of the pension business.
Instead, the city will offer generous contributions to employees' private retirement plans along with pay raises and restored benefits. The plan also opens the door for renegotiations if the economy changes, and because of that, local Fraternal Order of Police leader Steve Zona says he's cautiously optimistic.
There's no other city in Florida that has 401ks for public safety, so the outcome is yet to be determined.
The plan defers the bulk of pension debt payments until after the half-cent sales tax kicks in. Finally, Florida smoking rate is at an all-time low, and state officials attribute the precipitous drop to aggressive anti-smoking campaigns. But while the overall numbers are promising, tobacco use among millennials is on the rise. WJCT's Ryan Bank explains.
Florida has the 16th lowest rate of tobacco usage in the country. Yet disparities among counties continue vexing public health officials.
We are having to try to undo decades and decades of the tobacco industry's very specific targeting of these populations.
That's Tobacco Free Florida's Andrew Romero. He says counties like Union and Putnam have higher smoking rates than the state average of just under 16%, because marketing has historically targeted low-income rural areas where quality education and health care is harder to come by. At 17%, Duval's rate is just a little higher than the state's. The county is seeing a huge surge in youth users, though. Elizabeth Jensen is with Tobacco Free Jacksonville.
The 2016 Florida Youth Tobacco Survey found that more than one in three youth that are aged 11 to 17 in our county report trying tobacco products.
Jensen says while youth smoking rates are way down, young people's use of e-cigarettes is skyrocketing. The same youth survey found vaping is the most popular way for kids to first try tobacco.
21-year-olds, they're in college, they're working, they're not going to buy the cigarettes for, you know, that kid between 11 and 17 that's trying tobacco for the first time. So it just totally removes the social circle.
Jensen says her group is pushing for legislation to raise the smoking age to help curb what she calls a worrying trend. Both the House and Senate version of the age rescheduling bills have not yet been heard by a single committee. Ryan Bank, 89.9 WJCT News.
And that's our show. You can find all of our audio and web stories at wjctnews.org. You can also stream this podcast as well as all of our on-air content on the WJCT app, which is available on iTunes and the Google Play Store. And of course, find us on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. I'm Vince Kong, and thank you for listening.